Welcome back to Restless Viking Radio. This is Season 1, Episode 8, and it's Part 5 of the Cape Jones series. The part where the map stops being a concept and becomes wind, tide, and a man named Jimmy who does not waste words on feelings. If you've ever tried to lead a group into something remote, you know this truth. The plan doesn't break all at once. It breaks in tiny, polite increments. Until you look at your watch and realize the day is left without you. All right. Let's go to Long Point. This episode takes place on the shore of Long Point on James Bay. We're camped on the rocks with 10 people, freighter canoes down the hill, and one problem. We need two boats, and we have one. And for reasons I still can't fully explain, Jimmy shows up at 6:30 in the morning. I was still a little bleary-eyed as I crawled out of the back of my Jeep. Our camp on the shore of Long Point was still quiet. We were a lonely arrangement of jeeps on the rocks above the receding morning tide. A few of our team were just getting started with breakfast and coffee. The sound of gravel and tires faded into the calm morning sounds. I looked up to see Jimmy's truck slowly rounding the curve. Wow, I thought. He's early. It was 6:30 in the morning. When we had talked during our awkward negotiation the day before, we seemed to settle between 8 and 9. Jimmy said he would find another freighter canoe and guide and meet us where we camped in mid-morning. I slowly walked through the wet weeds to the gravel road, still a little sleepy. The air was fresh, chilled, and a little damp. The sun was new and the light was dim. He slowly rolled to a stop with his window down and stared at the canoes lined up just down the hill. Without looking at me, he put his truck in park, opened the door, and stepped out. I searched his face. He continued looking downhill. "Hey," I said, a little surprised he was so early. He nodded, still looking away, this time at the quiet ocean. He seemed to be sizing everything up. "I thought you said between 8 and 9, I said, trying to cover the fact that we weren't ready. "Wind, tide, good. We go now," he said with a nod to the ocean. I paused. "No second canoe?" I inquired. He smiled, glanced at me, a crooked, satisfied smile. That was his answer. We had 10 people in room for 5, maybe 6. I hesitated. "So, 2 trips, he said. "Okay," I said. "We get ready." I hesitated. I'd said it the way he would have. He nodded, still intently staring at the boats at the bottom of the hill. I started turning to walk away and followed his gaze down to the boats to see if there was a polar bear or something important. Nothing. We gathered at camp. Everyone had a curious look. We had doubts that a second trip would be possible. We discussed who would go on the first trip. I was a little optimistic that if we hurried on the first trip, we could make it back in time for the second one. At 35 miles an hour, we could go over 70 miles in 2 hours, spend 30 minutes on site, then return by noon or by 1 p.m. for the second round. I would later learn how optimistic that was. We chose the 5 for the first trip, those who had been with the team the longest. I hesitated, tried feebly to give up my spot, but they insisted. They knew I had planned to reach Cape Jones for more than a decade. To this day, I have a deep appreciation for them and their unwavering kindness. We weren't crossing James Bay, we were working our way north, following the coast, threading islands and shoals all the way to Cape Jones. After we gathered our gear, we walked down to the gravel beach, crunching across stones, past over 60 freighter canoes, a silent, heavy fleet waiting for the tide. Jimmy had a small generator charging his sat phone. His attention was absolute as he methodically arranged 7 large jugs of fuel. He shifted the heavy cans and rearranged gear as movements were efficient and economical. We fell in line, helping without instruction or conversation. Then, without saying a word, he reached into the back of his truck, pulled out 6 half-pipes, and dropped them on the gravel behind his 24-foot canoe. A 60-horsepower motor hung from the transom. It was old, and the prop was pretty dinged up. I swallowed as I walked around to the other side. Without saying a word, Jimmy positioned himself on the canoe and began pushing it to the water. Finally realizing what he was doing, we quickly grabbed the gunwales to helm. We slid the canoe closer to the water by about 6 feet. Jimmy picked up a half-pipe from the front. He walked with casual patience to the back and dropped it. We pushed again for another 4 feet and repositioned a half-pipe. After almost a dozen of those maneuvers, the boat was floating. Then Jimmy loaded gear without conversation. We loaded our gear, climbed in, and positioned ourselves in the seats. The last piece of gear, a cased shotgun, was placed in the bow, and then Jimmy loaded his truck and drove away to park it. When he returned, he pushed us all further out into the water, then climbed in. He fiddled with the motor for a couple minutes, occasionally pulling the cord. The rest of us used the hand-carved paddles to move slowly from the shore. Then the motor roared to life. The canoe vibrated and the gear rattled against the hull. With a clunk, we were in reverse and slowly backing away from the shore. The others watched us launch, two following for a while in their kayaks before turning back. The rest looked from shore. With another clunk, we came about to starboard. The canoe shuddered. I positioned myself at the bow of the canoe, expecting a rough but exciting ride. This is it. 70 more miles and we finally reach our goal. 35 gallons of fuel and 7 tank changes and we'll be back from Cape Jones. I was pretty excited. Cape Jones is one of those places with very little written history. The name was given by the English sometime in the 17th century. In 1961, it was officially renamed Point Louis XIV, a fact most of the people living within 300 miles seem unaware of. It's a long, rocky point stretching into the sea, marking where James Bay gives way to Hudson Bay, treeless and exposed. Right in the middle of the cape sits MCL Site Number 410, an abandoned radar station my father would have recognized. My father, who adopted me at 3 months, served on Bemuz radar sites, 1,000 miles north. But he hadn't just stayed on the base, he explored. Traded rides in military trucks for dog sled rides with the Inuit in Greenland. Wandered through abandoned towns in Alaska, actually reading letters left in the post office decades before. He was curious about the North in a way most servicemen weren't. We motored north through a maze of rocky, treeless islands. Jimmy would expertly maneuver through shallow passes with just a few inches between hull and rock. He would lift the motor, glide over a line of barely submerged rocks, then drop the motor and accelerate. He would then position the tiller between his legs to steer. He kept his hands in his pockets as he surveyed wildlife and harsh shorelines. He stood almost the entire time steering with his legs, his expression still and silent. We slid between rocks and shoals, Jimmy timing each move with the tide. One mistake here would mean a dunking. It meant an abandoned canoe, a ruined prop, and 6 people waiting days for rescue, all because of an inch of misplaced hull. I was behind the upswept bow, mostly protected from the wind. Farther back, without protection of the bow, the others were exposed. They dug in their packs for emergency blankets, trying to settle the needling chill. Their hunched posture, the way that they winced, told me they were miserable and probably wondering when it was all going to end. Riding in the bow was rough. Within 15 minutes, our course took us directly into the waves. Sitting was impossible, like riding a mechanical bull. I found a shaky equilibrium standing, locked in a low, slight squat while gripping the gunwales. It was comfortable enough for the first hour, but as the second hour began, the strain became an immediate, dull fire in my quads. I knew what this meant tomorrow, legs weak and trembling and aching pain settling deep in the quads and muscles that would simply refuse to move. I was going to look and feel like a tired old man. 3 hours, standing in the bow, legs burning. My father had done journeys like this too, not for duty, but out of curiosity. Trading with people, exploring abandoned places, collecting stories to bring home. We never talked about what drove that curiosity, but standing there, feeling the biting chill work its way through my jacket, I understood something. This was the conversation. Every mile closer to Cape Jones was a sentence I couldn't say out loud. Every hour on the water was a word he'd recognize. We passed many geese. As we got close, they would lay flat in the water to hide behind the waves. At times, Jimmy would turn to make his approach between two islands. When we got too close, they would flap and waddle, their little webbed feet kicking, taking flight to escape. At one point, a small seal was sunning herself on a rock, her huge eyes fixed on us. She dove into the water and her head popped up a minute later, much closer to us. She seemed curious and kept following us until our speed took us out of sight. And somewhere north of Long Point, the wind caught my hat. My kids had given it to me years earlier, a sun-bleached, frayed, grumpy hat that had seen better days. It skipped once and disappeared in the chop. I rode it off immediately. Jimmy saw it. He eased off the throttle. Then he began to turn the canoe. "Don't worry about it," I said. "It's old, pretty beat up." He paused, glanced over his shoulder, and cracked a crooked smile. "Expensive hat," he said. "We go back." Only then did the rest of us start looking like we were playing along. I leaned forward near the bow, scanning the water, thinking I'd wave him off in another minute. There was no way we were finding that brown hat in miles of dark water. Jimmy never searched. From the outboard at the back of the canoe, he brought us around once, then slowed. The hat drifted to the bow. From 24 feet back, running the motor, he had put it exactly where my hand was. I looked back at him. The smile was gone now. I grabbed my hat out of the icy water and he brought the throttle back up and we continued north as if the outcome had never been in doubt. After an hour, we stopped at a small rocky island. Jimmy talked on his radio in Cree. I hopped out with the rope. He threw out 2 fuel containers and crawled onto the shore to mix fuel with oil. He did this a couple times. He worked hard for us, and we never knew what he was planning, why we were stopping, or why we were turning. At one point, I looked back to notice that he'd left his position as stern sentinel and was rearranging gas cans. He disconnected the engine's fuel line from one can and connected it to another while the motor hummed on. I would try to understand how he was navigating dozens of miles of uncharted water. I could sometimes see his aid to navigation, a lone stick with an animal skull or a shipwreck part carefully stacked on an island knoll. He would take a heading straight at it, then promptly turn, and I would scan for the cairn set up on the next distant island. We passed a couple of camps the size of small villages, unmapped settlements that stood in hard contrast to the lonely landscape. Occasionally, Jimmy would chat with someone on the radio. During one transmission, he spoke in Cree, and I suddenly recognized the words Cape Jones. There was a long pause at the other end, then suddenly, "Oa, oa, oa," which is a Cree expression of WTF with a smile. I kept track of our progress on the satellite tracker, and it was painfully slow. We left at low tide and into the wind, just the right conditions for crawling up the coast. We were still over 15 miles from the Cape after 3 hours. At a fuel stop on one of the countless islands, he announced, "Cape Jones, not long," as he loaded the tank and the fuel can back into the canoe. Shortly after we left, with about 6 miles to go, we rounded a point and immediately spotted the imposing antenna arrays at the Cape. They were small at the distance, but striking as they languished in the haze. These arrays had their anchor bolts cut more than 50 years ago during decommissioning. They assumed that the wind would easily topple them. But there they were, still suffering the elements, unwavering. For the next 20 minutes, we moved closer with the Cape slowly growing. The wide expanse of open water was still rife with submerged obstacles. With 3 miles to go, we spotted the Cape Jones hunting camp, a couple of small buildings on the shore at the destination. Finally, we closed in on our landing site near a small cabin. Jimmy cut the motor and we drifted. I finally jumped out with the rope, my legs trembling a little. We secured the canoe, and Jimmy unloaded some gear. He looked at me and said, "What do you want to do?" "Stay a bit. Look around, walk to the towers, curious to know if that was okay." "You take pictures, walk around. I'll have lunch," he said. With that, he busied himself, hauling gear to a shelter area among the rocks and lichen. I quickly started hiking toward the towers just over a rocky knoll. We all split up for our own silent exploration. As I passed the small hunting cabin comfortably nestled in the hill, a raven the size of a small child suddenly stumbled at the back of the building. I think we both jumped, surprised to see each other in this empty place. His wings flapped as he regained his balance and he took flight. He flew to the top of a knoll, landed on a rocky perch, and kept watch over me. I thought of Odin's ravens, my birth family's Icelandic mythology, not my father's Scottish roots. I know, it was indulgent, maybe even disloyal. But the raven stayed. And I kept walking. The hike was treeless and seemed to expand forever. The towers loomed like giants in the distance. The raven stayed behind, still and stoic, with his feathers waving in the wind. I walked alone across the tundra as an angry bird circled above me and screeched. The silence, the kind my father would have known, sucked away any noise I made. In today's world, someone would probably ask why I hadn't just called him, why I hadn't told him what this meant. But standing there, among the rusted drums and broken steam pipes, I understood. This was telling him. Not in spite of the silence, but because of it. The Cree don't talk about honoring their ancestors. They live it. They walk the routes their grandfathers walked. My father and I do the same. I pulled out my phone and took a picture of the towers, not for social media, not even for myself, but for him. We all converged on the buildings, like some sort of great gathering of travelers. We explored the disintegrating buildings, steam pipes broken and shattered, ceilings bowed, walls slowly leaning until they fell. The sun was bright and the wind was gentle and steady. We began our amble back to the canoe. Returning to the landing site on Cape Jones, Jimmy was finishing lunch. His campfire was done and he offered me a pork chop. I graciously accepted, a little surprised. We launched and for hours we traced the edge of the land. Sometimes the shore was close enough to feel. Other times it drifted miles away, broken into low islands and narrow channels. We slid between rocks and shoals, Jimmy timing each move to the tide, reading water depth the way some people read a clock. The radio had been silent all morning. There was no one to talk to. I kept checking our distance, speed, tide. I sent short updates on the satellite messenger, careful not to promise anything. I checked the GPS and looked at my watch, 2 p.m. We wouldn't see Long Point until 5. The window had closed hours ago and I finally accepted it. We failed the other 5. The radio crackled to life. A tugboat was heading north, following the same ragged coastline. They hailed Jimmy. Hearing another voice out here felt unexpected, almost intrusive. He answered in Cree. At first it sounded casual, but the exchange went on longer than I expected. Jimmy spoke a little, listened more, eyes forward, tiller between his legs. When it ended, he said nothing. We kept moving, slipping between islands again. Water rose and fell against the rocks. After a while, I asked what they'd said. He shrugged. They think I should have two boats, for safety. He didn't sound like he was just lectured. He went back to watching the water. By the time we reached Long Point, the second group was waiting on the rocks. I tied up, climbed out, and started apologizing more than once. For the time, for the hope, for doing the math out loud. And they wouldn't have it. That was enough. They were gracious, insistent, almost stubborn about it. That took most of the 10 minutes. While talking, I kept glancing at Jimmy. He was packing, fuel cans, rope, gear, fast and efficient, like a man closing an account. I finally broke away, money in hand, and started walking toward him. I was still a good 50 yards away when he shut the back of his truck. He got in and drove off. By the time we crossed paths again the next morning, Cape Jones was already behind us. Jimmy was sitting with his wife in a small restaurant, halfway through breakfast. No introduction, no ceremony. Just a table by the window in a morning that clearly hadn't been arranged around us. And I stopped and said hello. He said hello back. I told him we needed to settle up. He nodded. That was it. I had the distinct feeling I was interrupting something private, not rudely, just improperly. So I left them alone and went back to our table across the room. Coffee, eggs, the low murmur of the place waking up. After a while, Jimmy stood up. I expected him to come over. Instead, he and his wife headed for the door. I got up and followed. In the entryway, that narrow space between two doors where the cold always sneaks in, I called his name. He stopped and turned. I handed him a wad of cash. And it was more than we talked about days earlier. Maybe twice as much. In standing there, I realized I wasn't even sure if we'd ever actually agreed on a price. He looked at the money. "What's this for?" he asked. "For taking us to Cape Jones." He took it. No thanks, just a nod. Then he turned and left. A day or two later, we were back in the commercial center again, waiting. Darcy was there, full of energy, surrounded by people laying out his thatched geese like a man who knew exactly how long attention lasts. He was insistent, not rude, just determined that we weren't going anywhere until a transaction happened. People gathered, watched, drifted in and out. At some point, I realized Jimmy was standing beside me. He hadn't announced himself. He was just there, watching the same thing I was. For a moment, neither of us said anything. Then he leaned over and asked if I wanted him to talk to Darcy, see if he can get me a better price. It surprised me. Not the offer, but the assumption behind it. That we were together in this moment, that advocating was natural. I said something noncommittal, maybe yes, maybe we'd see, and we kept watching. A few minutes later, he turned to me. "How long are you staying?" he asked. I told him we were leaving the next morning. Then I asked if the white female captain had talked to him. He said yes. That's when the smile appeared. Not big, not performative, just easy, genuine. He reached into his pocket and pulled out a check. He held it where only I could see it. $2,500. I reacted with surprise and something like pride. It felt like a lot of money to him, though I don't really know. What I did know was that he was happy. It was the first time I had seen him like that, and it explained the rest. I had met that captain earlier, right after we got back from the Cape. She was with the Royal Canadian Geographic Society, the Canadian cousin to National Geographic. Licensed captain, institutional backing, purpose. She wanted a guide. They were working on the coast, mapping routes, learning the waters, filling in places where charts were thin or non-existent. She said they'd been looking for someone for over a week. She carried herself like someone who was used to being listened to. Just enough to make sure I understood where I ranked, which was ironic. I probably had more northern miles behind me than she did. But credentials matter differently in different places. The band office suggested she talk to me. Apparently, she also stopped in the office to see if she could find someone, just like we did. I agreed to meet her. I told her to ask Jimmy. She asked for his number, insistently. I told her I didn't have it, but she could usually find him in the commercial center, sitting. She seemed impatient with that, as if sitting wasn't a serious answer. I tried to help anyways. I offered that insisting wouldn't get her very far here, that sharing would. Then I said she could tell him I sent her the guy he had just taken to Cape Jones. She treated the suggestion like it was acceptable. Then she left. And frankly, I'm glad she did. Later, Jimmy showed me that check. I like to think he was hired because we sent her. That without that thin thread of connection, it wouldn't have happened. But that's not really the point. What mattered was why she wanted him. They weren't documenting the coast. They were designing it. Mapping routes that could become curated experiences. Authentic feeling eco-travel for people unwilling or unable to do what we had done. Packaged access. Jimmy took the money. Of course he did. The system that displaced his people now offers survival through performance. That isn't hypocrisy. It's economics. And it isn't new. We paid him more than we agreed to. I was happy he got an institutional check. Both things were true. But neither thing was clean. While we were there, interest in us quietly grew. Online posts appeared, white people at Long Point, watch your stuff. Some white people poking around the graveyard. Nothing dramatic, nothing hostile. Just information moving through a network we weren't a part of. The sitters weren't just sitting, they were watching, reporting, deciding. While I thought I was having individual encounters, the community was having a collective conversation about us. And I didn't know that at the time, but it explains a lot. At the end of the trip, we were back in the commercial center again. Someone asked where we were headed next. Someone asked us not to leave. The radio station asked if we wanted to do an interview, but we declined. Partly because we were leaving, but mostly because I didn't know what to say. We weren't the story. We hadn't come to explain Chisasibi. We had just shown up slowly and waited to see if we'd be tolerated. That didn't feel like something you put on the air. Eventually, we did what everyone does. We left. A year later, I came back. Different group, different destination, just one night in Chisasibi, passing through. No agenda, no expectation of recognition. It was the opening of goose season. Canoes came in low and heavy, piled with birds. My group stood back, unsure. Without thinking, I stepped forward and grabbed a canoe to help pull it ashore. The rest of the group followed immediately. A teenage boy, proud, trying not to show it, was standing in the boat with a shotgun. I asked how the hunt went. He held up his goose and let his prize linger for a bit, so I understood. To me, it was just an interaction with people I had met. That was the difference. The next morning, I went looking for Jimmy in the Sitters Mall. He wasn't there. A quiet disappointment when you realize you'd hoped, without admitting, to see someone. In the parking lot, just as we were about to leave, I spotted him, and I yelled his name. He turned, smiled broadly, and walked toward me. We shook hands. Then we stood there. Long pauses. Answers like, good? Yep. A nod. Silence again. This time it wasn't tense. We weren't evaluating. We were just there. Eventually I said, take care. He nodded and walked away like he hadn't known me very well. And I took that as good. Cape Jones felt like an ending. It wasn't. If I had gone on the radio, maybe I would have said this. Come slowly. Come humbly. Be willing to be told no. Help pull the canoes. Stand in silence. And if you're lucky enough to be welcomed, come back. But that won't fit on a brochure. Brochures bring money north. So Jimmy will guide the tourists, and I'll come back when I can. And somehow, we'll both know the difference. Cape Jones didn't give us a conclusion. It didn't explain itself. It didn't thank us for coming. It didn't even pretend to notice we'd been there. And maybe that was the point. We packed up. The boats went back in the water. The trucks pointed south. One by one, the voices thinned out. And the trip ended the way most of them do, not all at once, but unevenly. Cape Jones felt like an ending. It wasn't. It was just where the group stopped. The road kept going. It bent east. It followed colder water. Next time, I went alone. Next time, it's Labrador, and it's Thanksgiving. Stay tuned.